Let's talk. John Brown. Forbidden but allowed. The Anomalies of Saudi Arabia. It's an intimate memoir of a British expatriate navigating life in Saudi Arabia from 1984 to 1998, an era when the kingdom, well, it's a strict and closed society. Here to tell me more about it is the author of Forbidden But Allowed, Busy Frost. Busy, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Giles. It's great to be on your show again.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining me. Always good to have you with us. So this is the second book, isn't it, that you've written about time in Saudi?
Yes, it is. The first one was Travels with Mara Dadi, Harley Davidson Adventures Around Saudi Arabia. And that was actually at the end of our time in Saudi, because we were there a total of 31 years. And then this one goes right back to the beginning when we very first arrived there in 1984.
So what propelled you to Saudi? Why did you go to Saudi Arabia in 1984? And did you kind of think it was going to be a bit of a daunting prospect in the 80s?
Well, I'll answer that straight away. Yes, I did think it was going to be a very daunting prospect. But we were living in Kenya, and in Kenya, we had to pay for our kids' education. It's not like in the UK where you get your state education. And we had two small children, and we thought, we've got to find a way to give these kids a good education. So it was a sort of springboard to provide our kids with a good education. And we didn't think we'd be in Saudi for 31 years. My husband was an airline pilot and he was a captain. And when airline pilots change to a different company, they tend to lose their seniority and go back to being first officers. And he was very reluctant to do that. And Saudi Arabia was the only airline offering direct entry captains. So we ended up going there.
So, because Saudi Arabia is a massive country. So what part of Saudi did you A, end up in, and B, what were your first impressions? I mean, obviously you're an Africa hand, as the saying goes, but yeah. I mean, Saudi is Saudi is different, isn't it? Let's face it.
We were going to Jeddah, which is on the Red Sea. And at the time, it was the most liberal of the cities in Saudi. And my first impressions were actually pretty devastating, because I ended up having lived in a lovely little three-bedroom cottage in a one-acre garden in Kenya, ended up in a low-rise apartment, first floor, a small flat, two small children, forbidden to drive, forbidden to work. And I just thought, what have I done with my life? I felt like I'd completely lost control of my own life.
Because obviously Saudi at that time, I mean, a lot of expats, you know, go over to work there, but my sister was a nurse at the Royal Hospital but it's compound life. I mean, it wasn't a case of, oh, I think I'll get myself a little villa overlooking the Red Sea. So explain what that sort of shock is like then.
Well, that was almost more of a culture shock than going to Saudi Arabia itself, because we'd never lived in a compound where you're isolated from the community who are actually the host country. Our compound was very big. It was a square kilometer. It could house about 5,000 families. And it had lots of swimming pools and leisure facilities and things. But it was quite strange. And our compound only housed airline personnel.
Right.
So to begin with, yeah. Yeah, any expatriate who worked for Saudi Arabian Airlines, that's where they had to live.
Presumably then, it's quite an interesting mix of people, because you've got people who have, I mean, at that time, you didn't know you were going to be there for the best part of three decades.
Yeah.
And you've lived in Kenya. Did you find that the people who were living in Saudi were there for different reasons? What was your first impression of the actual, because, you know, you land and you've got a sort of, the kids are going to make new friends, go to new school, but obviously your husband's going to be working, and presumably you've got to, and again, this is a different age, but you've got to sort of, what were you hoping to do? Were you thinking you're going to sort of, I don't know, coffee mornings with the other wives? I know it sounds like it's always Victorian, but what did you think you were going to do?
Well, the thought of coffee mornings actually filled me with horror. That just wasn't me at all. And so I thought, oh, well, I better buy a sewing machine, start making my own clothes, make the children's clothes. I used to quite enjoy sewing, but I'd left behind a career as a freelance photographer, and it broke my heart to leave all that behind. And I didn't realize how badly that affected me until I got to Saudi Arabia and found I couldn't do it anymore. That was me. You know, I was a photographer. And yeah, it was pretty devastating. So the only people I met at the beginning were the wives of other pilots that my husband was working with. And one of those women was absolutely amazing. Her name was Annie Freeman. I'm still in touch and great friends with her. But Annie was the one who introduced us to all sorts of really interesting people who made our lives fantastic in those first few years.
When you say interesting people, because you know, this is old Saudi Arabia, this is a very strict society.
Yeah.
Did you actually get to meet many people, many Saudis on a day-to-day basis, or was it all quite controlled?
No, we didn't meet any Saudis at all. These were all expatriates, but expatriates who, one of them, he was a man who worked for P&O Shipping. He had access to a very, very nice cabin cruiser that we all used to go out scuba diving on the Red Sea. And then the other couple were amazing. He was the Australian trade consul and his wife, and they ran a bar called the Dead Dingo. And the Dead Dingo was Monday night at the Dingo. You know, we all went there. You never miss Monday night at the Dingo. And this was one of the few places where you could sort of network and meet all sorts of business people from different parts of the community. So once I started with my photography, that's how I got quite a lot of my work, was through the Dead Dingo.
Obviously you've been briefed about the situation in Saudi Arabia at the time and the things that you could and couldn't do. But did you sort of think, yeah, well, I'm sure there's a way so we can, I'm sure that's just them sort of trying to scare us. Was the reality more than you had imagined? Because again, you've come from Kenya, you know, you've come from Europe, you've got a photography career, women are allowed to drive, etc. Was the actual harsh reality quite an eye-opener for you then, Busy?
Well, it was completely different to what I expected. I mean, yes, we couldn't drive. That was a given. But the working aspect, the forbidden to work, all our husbands had to sign a document saying they would forbid us to work. But all my girlfriends, we all worked. So once you got there, you discovered, hey, actually, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And my photography kicked off because a guy living upstairs from us left a note on the door saying, hey, they're looking for female photographers. Go and have a look at this notice. So I went and had a look at it, rang the studio who was advertising, and then I discovered that all these women-only events, because the Saudi society was completely segregated. It was women-only. They celebrated the weddings on their own. The men had their celebration. But all these women-only events had to have female photographers. And suddenly, whoop, you know, there I was. I had all this wonderful freelance work, which took me into the Saudi community to photograph all kinds of different Saudi weddings, sometimes up in the hills in small towns, seeing tribal weddings. And it was just absolutely amazing.
Because, I mean, I suppose, you know, to the layman, Saudi is just an awful lot of sand, flat, an awful lot of oil, etc. And because it was so close, we didn't know much about society, about the matriarchy, about the hills, and about the tribe. So just sort of tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, the country is, the landscape is very, very varied, and running all the way from the south in Yemen all the way up to Jordan, there's a fantastic mountain range. And you would go from sort of 0 feet at sea level, climb up these amazing escarpment roads, and then you'd be at, 6,000 feet, 2,000 meters, and the temperature would drop 20 degrees in that time. And then you'd have these fantastic roads going along the tops of the mountains. And we did many really amazing camping trips, you know, either up in the mountains or going over the mountains to places beyond. And then you'd get to more desert areas, and the desert itself Especially when you see the sand dunes. Sand dunes are very, very beautiful, as you've seen in many photographs. But that was all a wonderful surprise. And to begin with, we did our camping trips on our own, which surprised a lot of people. They thought, you can't go in the desert on your own. That's far too dangerous. But we came from Africa. We were used to doing stuff like that. And then we started teaming up with other people who liked it, that we didn't say we're going camping. We said we're going on safari, and they kind of liked that expression. So off we went on safari to places, you know, 700 kilometers away, 1,000 kilometers away, following the old Hejaz railway that was built by the Turks at the turn of the last century, and which Lawrence of Arabia then blew up. And we had wonderful times following the old Hejaz railway, going to a place called Madain Saleh, which is the second important Nabataean settlement after Petra. And most people will have heard of Petra in Jordan and have seen pictures of its wonderful stone tombs all carved into the rock. Well, the second most important one of those was in Saudi Arabia. So that was another very popular place to go on safari.
When you went out of the compound, did you feel like you were being monitored? Because obviously you've got sort of the religious police, you know, wandering around the place. So did you, you know, as, because again, the Westerners going off on safari, I suppose, wasn't a thing that most people did. So, you know, did you sort of feel, did you run into them? I mean, were they understanding? I mean, what was your experience like with the authorities, you know, on the road? Because obviously you were quite, this was something quite new to them as well.
Yeah, well, the compound obviously isolated us from all that aspect and allowed us all to get on with our own way of life, including brewing our own alcohol. You had, in those early days, you had to get a letter of permission from your company to leave town, even if you were going scuba diving on a boat. And so, when we went on these trips, you had to have your IDs with you, your passports with you, your travel letter with you. And you did go through quite a lot of checkpoints. And then they'd, you know, check inside the car and look for contraband and see if there was any alcohol in your car, which quite often there was, but it was very carefully hidden. But you didn't come across the religious police out there, and you didn't feel you were being monitored at all. But in the shopping malls, there were often religious police. And when prayer time went up, because all the shops, banks, petrol station, everything closed at prayer time 4 times a day. There are 5 prayers, but one of them was too early in the morning. And then the religious police would come around and make sure that all the shops were shut. And occasionally they'd get very officious if people were deemed to be, the women weren't dressed modestly enough, and then they could be quite officious and unpleasant.
Talking about, you're going, so you're photographing Saudi weddings, the women at Saudi weddings. That must have been, that must have been a real eye opener for both parties. Because you are going into, you know, a hugely symbolic event in the calendar and the society, and presumably Saudi women hadn't had that much contact with Westerners either. So it must have been a very interesting experience for both parties.
I didn't get that feeling, actually. I think by the time I started doing it, they were already kind of used to that and having photographers at weddings. So I never really got that feeling at all. But it was just a really interesting experience. And it was quite funny when the bride would, when she arrived with her groom, even though he would be the only man in the room full of sort of 500 women. And then there'd be this sort of panic, because when the bride and groom arrived, there'd be this wonderful ululating and beating of drums from a group of women called the Zafarin. And then the women at the wedding, you know, they would have taken off their black abayas. They'd be wearing all their wonderful evening dresses and clothes and things, which they could only wear in front of other women. And so when this bridegroom arrived, it was like, panic, 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 quick, quick, got to cover our faces, got to cover. And, you know, you'd find about three or four of them, they'd pick up the edge of the tablecloth and pull it up to sort of cover their faces so only their eyes were showing. I mean, this bridegroom didn't have time to look around the room and check out all the other women. But at the same time, it was a time when the young women would dress up to look their best, because there would be the wedding matchmakers spotting for young ladies, for their sons, nephews to marry. So they were
fascinating. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. you started writing as well. You started getting into journalism as well, didn't you, at this time? I mean, yeah. Presumably this is for publications in the compound rather than, I should imagine stringing back to London would be was there censorship if you were writing back to the UK? I mean, how did that all come about?
No, this was for, we had two national daily newspapers, and one was called the Arab News, which was nicknamed the Green Truth because it had a green sort of, the paper was tinted green. And then the one I wrote for was called the Saudi Gazette. So I was writing for a national newspaper, and I got into that by joining a writers group in our compound. And then one of the girls there was already writing for the Saudi Gazette. She took me and introduced me to the editor, and I'd always had a secret dream to be a journalist. You know, I loved, absolutely loved writing, and it was my best subject at school. And so, you know, when you're a freelancer, you just have to come up with your own ideas. You're not told what to write. And so I just wrote about teaching my kids how to swim. Then I did a travel article about Kenya. And then I love interviewing people and hearing their life stories and what their work is. So then I started doing a lot of interviews and got to interview a lot of Saudi men. And that was a very interesting experience, because I thought, how are they going to react to being interviewed by a woman? But expatriate women were almost treated like a third gender, because they knew we were used to being with men, working with men, socializing with men. So they were completely comfortable with us and very, very charming. Their manners were superb. And I had some really nice interviews with one of the top photographers in Saudi, and then the director general of the Jeddah port, and, you know, all sorts of quite high profile men.
Yeah, because if you're in the compound, I suppose there are lots of interesting people, because that's how they, you know, if you live the expat lifestyle or the international lifestyle, yeah, everybody's got a story. You know, we find it here in Spain. You know, people come over here and they've come from all over the place.
Yeah.
And also, Saudi is, they're looking westwards, aren't they? Because they know at that level that there's an awful lot of investment comes, or there's a great crossover. So you do get the West, you know, the westernized view of things as well.
Mm-hmm. I didn't really go for interviewing people within the compound. Years and years later, I did have a column which was interviewing expatriates about their lives in Saudi Arabia. But at this earlier point in my career, I was looking much more to interviewing people in the Saudi community and outside the compound, and doing quite a few travel articles about our trips around Saudi Arabia, and any trip that we did outside Saudi Arabia as well. That made for good copy.
Did you feel there was going to be any change in the wind? Because now Saudi is obviously, it has opened itself up to the West in a way, with sporting events, with leisure facilities, with, you know, they're going for the World Cup, for example. At that time, was there any inkling of that, or did you see a change whilst you were there? Because it was King Fahd, presumably, at that point, who was running.
It was King Fahd, yeah. Then in 2005, actually, there was a big change in 1991 after the Gulf War, because the religious element of Saudi Arabia and also Osama bin Laden, they were very, very upset that King Fahd didn't accept the help of Osama bin Laden and his Mujahideen, who came back from Afghanistan. And the king rejected their assistance to protect Saudi Arabia against Saddam Hussein. And then there was a big influx of American and European troops. And of course, among those troops were women soldiers. And that really upset the religious faction that there were women soldiers protecting Saudi Arabia. And so after the Gulf War, there was a huge crackdown by the religious police in Saudi Arabia. They started forcing expatriate women to wear the black abaya. Up till then, we didn't have to. There were many, many more of them patrolling all the shops and being really quite unpleasant a lot of the time. And so instead of going forward, so I thought after the Gulf War, it would all sort of go progressively, you know, more liberal, but it didn't. It went completely the other way. And in 2005, which is beyond the actual time of my book, when King Abdullah came in, that's when things did begin to get a little bit more liberal and the religious police were moved off the streets. But yeah, there was no indication at all that Saudi Arabia was going to become more liberal. None, no indication at all.
Why did you, I mean, you're there for 30 years. When did you know it was time to sort of head out? Was it a business decision? And you didn't think, oh, well, we'd like to buy a little cottage on the Red Sea and stay. Yeah.
Definitely not that. We wouldn't have been allowed to anyway. No, my husband is an airline pilot. Once he reached 65, that was it. Curtains, you know, he had to retire. And we went back to Kenya again. So we divide our time between Kenya and London. And, you know, we were both born in Kenya. We grew up there, went to school there. So it was very much going home again. And it was quite sad leaving Saudi Arabia because, you know, we'd been there for 31 years and it gets under your skin a bit. And I don't know if you read my previous book or not, but we did a final farewell tour in that one. We did a 6,500-mile tour on our Harley Davidson to say goodbye to Saudi Arabia because, you know, the place, especially to me, I had a very strong emotional attached to it. It had really got under my skin, but I did have a sort of love-hate relationship with it. You know, on the one hand, I absolutely loved it, and on the other hand, it drove me nuts with all its rules and regulations.
But I mean, that's the same with anywhere. I mean, you know, you're in Kenya. You know, you spent time in Kenya as well. I mean, it's pretty much the same. We all have those things. Did you have the mother of all blowout parties at the Dirty Dingo then, or had that long gone when you were leaving?
No, that's a long gone. That went in about 1991, actually. So no, we didn't have one of those. We just had a great party in our own flat.
So. I mean, would you like to go back? I mean, is this book sort of a, if you like, a snapshot of time, a memoir, a love letter to Saudi? I mean, what's the spark behind this book?
I think I just really wanted to write about an era when, you know, we lived through a very interesting time there. And it was a very unusual sort of lifestyle. And whenever I came out of Saudi Arabia on holiday or anything, people, you know, they couldn't hear enough about what's it like living there? What do you do there? How is this? How is that? And so I had a lot of material to draw on. I had all my photographs. I had all my articles that I'd written. So a lot of contemporaneous information to draw on. And I just wanted to record it all, especially for my family, you know, grandchildren, yeah, and all that as well.
What are you hoping, yeah, that people are going to learn or people are going to take from the book?
Well, I hope especially that it will inspire women, you know, if they find themselves in difficult situations, living in different difficult places, not to give up, to sort of be positive, to reinvent yourself and to dig deep and not necessarily use the talents that you hope to use when you were in another country, but, you know, start off small and all sorts of things will start to happen.
The book, is called Forbidden But Allowed. It's by Busy Frost, who we're speaking to again on TRE. A regular guest. If people want to find you online and say nice things to you, where can they find you, Busy?
I've got a Facebook page, which is Busy Elizabeth Frost. Elizabeth's my full name. So they can leave messages there. Then there's also my page, which is 30 years in Saudi Arabia. Also on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter or anything. I've got a photography website called Busy Frost Photography.
And you can order the book. You can order the book from our own virtual bookstore, which I urge you to do. The book is called Forbidden But Allowed. It's by Busy Frost, who is speaking to you today. Busy, it's been lovely to speak to you again this morning.
Great to talk to you again, Giles, as well. Thank you so much.